baseball season is in full swing right now. And it's exciting. It's an exciting time here, obviously, in Chicago because we have the defending World Series champs in the Chicago Cubs. And an incredible season last year, and we're hoping for a repeat this year. Baseball season is one of the best times of year. And whenever we have baseball season, we like to talk a lot about baseball. And one of the leading guys who's ever written about baseball is a terrific writer named Paul Dixon. And he is the author of more than like 65 nonfiction books, a lot of them about baseball. We're going to talk about some of the other books that he's written about baseball. But his latest is Leo Durocher, Baseball's Prodigal Son. It's available now. We have a link on our Facebook page, facebook.com/NickDShow, for all the information. And it's a terrific book about a really colorful and interesting guy in the history of baseball, the one and only Leo Durocher. Let's welcome back to the show Paul Dixon. Paul, welcome back, sir.
Thank you, Nick.
How are you?
Tremendous.
Good. Let's talk a little bit about your background. You've written over 60 nonfiction books, and how did you begin writing, Paul?
Oh, I wanted to be a writer, and there was something very appealing about it for me. And then when I got in the service, I did a lot of writing in college. When I got in the service, I started freelancing literally from the deck of an aircraft carrier. I was getting stuff published in the New York papers and stuff, travel pieces to begin with. But
yeah,
anytime I can remember, I wanted to do it. And started out as a journalist, and I've been freelance for, 50 years now or something.
Wow. Well, that's congratulations, man, on getting it done.
Yeah.
So let's talk about your history with baseball. Paul, when did you become a baseball fan?
I went to my first game. You're not going to believe this, but I'm going to tell you anything. I went to my uncle. I was born in 1939.
Mm-hmm.
My uncle came back from the South Pacific in 1944. He was waiting to get on their ship and ship out again. And he lost a ship, and we went to Yankee Stadium as a 5-year-old, and with this guy in full uniform. They ushered us into the game. They took us right to the Yankees clubhouse.
Wow.
We met Tommy Hendrick, who was also in the Coast Guard, but he had the same uniform as my uncle. And they took us down to the owner's box, and I said to my uncle, I love this game.
Well, sure, right out of the gate with an experience like that, how are you not going to love that game?
Yeah. But it's been part of my life. And, part of the thing that drew me to people, writing about personalities, Bill Veeck first and then Leo, was growing up in that period, that golden age, New York had three teams, and it was pretty exciting.
Yeah, and by the way, your book about Bill Veeck is great, and I think that was one of the last time you were on. I think after that, but I remember vividly talking to you and really loving that book. And it's obviously being a Chicagoan, the book is also, and having lived through that whole time period with Bill Veeck, it's such a colorful character here locally. It's a tremendous book,
and his reputation gets better almost by the day. I mean, it's way beyond now Eddie Goodell and Disco Demolition.
That
he really changed the game.
Yeah.
And he really ushered in the era of men and women and children coming to the ballpark. He started that with the Cubs, actually, when his father owned, right after his father died, who was the president of the Cubs.
Yeah. Yeah, interesting stuff. Great book. But we're going to talk about the Leo Durocher book, Baseball's Prodigal Son. And I do want to mention some of the other books that you've written that are baseball related. By the way, what team do you follow now? You're a Yankees fan?
No, I'm a Baltimore Orioles fan. My kids grew up here in Maryland, and we went to a lot of games when I was a kid, and I got to learn when they were kids. I got to love Earl Weaver and all that.
Yeah. Earl Weaver, there's a guy to write a book about.
Who was an apostle of Durocher's. I mean, you learned a lot from Durocher.
Yeah. I have to say, I went to Camden Yards the year that it opened in 92.
Yeah.
And I love that park. It was brand new at the time. I really, really love that park. Is it holding up?
It is holding up beautifully. And they redo it every winter. And every spring, it's like going into a new ballpark. I mean, they've done magnificent job of sort of engineering the fan experience to the highest degree. The food is still fantastic.
Yeah. Beautiful place. I remember being really, really, and it was interesting because that place opened a year after the new Comiskey, which was just such a disaster. when New Comiskey opened, and then we go to Camden Yards. We're like, oh, this is how you're supposed to do a new stadium. And they got it right. They got it right. So let's talk a little bit about. I want to talk about the new Dixon Baseball Dictionary a little bit.
Well, there's a third edition now called the Dixon Baseball Dictionary, and that's a big, big book. It's over 10,000 entries and about 18,000 definitions, and it's I'm keeping up with it. We're working on a fourth edition now, so it's an extraordinary task. I've got other people helping me with it, but it's. You know, I'm trying to be the Webster of baseball.
Right. I mean, some of the terms I want to get some of your favorites. But I was watching the opening night, the season opener last week on ESPN. Obviously, the Cubs. Opening against the Cardinals, and I can't remember which announcer said this. But at one point, he said, "This is going to be interesting to see what they do here with the bases drunk." Now, I've never heard that. I can understand it's bases loaded because loaded is another term for drunk. But I've never heard, especially an announcer, say bases drunk. Have you ever heard that one before, Paul?
Yeah, but it's an old, old term. It goes back to Prohibition. I mean, because there were so many. I actually did another book on. I'm in the Guinness Book of World Records for the most number of synonyms, and those are the synonyms for drunk, believe it or not.
Oh, yeah, we talked about that, yeah.
But they do use that before. But I think what happens in baseball is every time you think a term is never going to be used again in the history of humankind, somebody will say, well, that's a can of corn, or that's a dying quail, or that's a this.
Yeah.
And that whole business... It's because baseball is so still really tied to radio, almost more than it is to television. Believe it or not, I mean, you still have that great voice in the night telling you, you know, that somebody's about to hit for the cycle or something's going to happen.
Yeah,
you know that is and the vocabulary and the language of baseball is just enhanced by all that stuff. And now we have analytics, which is driving us all crazy.
Mm-hmm.
So, with all these new terms that sound like, you know, atomic physics or something.
Well, you know, you mentioned can of corn, which a broadcaster here in Chicago, Hawk Harrelson for the Chicago White Sox, says can of corn all the time.
Yeah.
And where did that come from? Where does can of corn come from?
The best evidence is that it goes back to the old days of grocery stores, before supermarkets, when the grocer, you'd ask him for a can of corn, and he'd take out this long pole with a hook on it, a grabber, and he'd pull down the corn, and he'd pull out his apron, and the can of corn would come tumbling down head over heels and land softly in his apron.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, otherwise it makes no sense whatsoever.
It doesn't make, yeah, I know. You got to love that kind of jargon, man. And so you're working on another edition of that one, huh?
Yeah, it'll be the fourth.
Wow.
We do them every 10 years. Japan that's sort of coming over, and there's always new terms for pitches. Pitches are always being renamed, or there's a new version. And the analytics is just bringing an avalanche of new stuff.
Yeah. Well, it's interesting. Now, did you watch the World Series this last year?
Oh, yeah.
Wasn't it, I mean, I'm, you know, obviously I'm biased, Paul, because I'm a diehard, you know, lifelong Cub fan. But I got to say, that was an amazing World Series. I mean,
it was amazing, and both teams were amazing.
Yeah.
It wasn't you know, it wasn't a Goliath, David and Goliath thing. It was two Goliaths.
Yeah.
You know, it was a great, it was probably the best game seven in my lifetime.
I would agree. It was such an unbelievable game seven, like historic game seven.
Yeah.
I'm glad it ended up the way it did, but it couldn't have been more dramatic. That game was insane, and I was losing my mind watching it. And then I remember sitting on the couch when the rain delay happened. I'm like, you got to be kidding me. It's a rain delay.
I know, and a lot of people. I think I napped, but because it was an arduous thing. I mean, it was very exciting, but it was also at the end of the game. I've got my eyes propped open with toothpicks, you know, trying to stay awake.
Yeah,
but you know, it was interesting for me, especially because I had just finished the Leo Durocher book, and I had been living with the 69 Cubs and Leo in Chicago.
Yeah, yeah.
For the Cubs it was a humiliating season because they'd been ahead, you know, the Mets caught them.
Yeah.
And So I was reliving all that stuff. I mean, I'm not from Chicago, but I had gotten, through some friends, I'd gotten a lot of the old clippings from the Chicago American, the Chicago, you know, all the papers that are no longer in Chicago.
Right.
As well as the, you know, the ones that are there now. So I was following that season through the eyes of these wonderful reporters who were back then, you know, working for the various Chicago Daily News and the Chicago Today and such. And it was really interesting to see the two, because my thesis, more than a thesis, I mean, I'm a reporter, not a thesis builder, but is that a lot of that loss could be laid right at the feet of Leo Durocher.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you talk about that in the book too.
Yeah,
he was a part of some really historical teams and seasons just as a manager alone.
Yeah, no, and he comes. I mean, as a player,
yeah.
An amazing player. And he plays for the Yankees. He plays for the Cincinnati Reds. He's part of the Gas House Gang in St. Louis.
Mm-hmm.
You know, he goes on to the Brooklyn Dodgers, where he's a player. Then, you know, first game is in 1925.
Wow.
Last game as a player is 45. And then in Brooklyn, he becomes player manager and then ultimately manager. And in that uniform, he's the guy who brings up Jackie Robinson and facilitates him coming up,
mm-hmm.
and at the same time gets banned, comes back to the Dodgers. He's tossed over to the Giants, which was like in New York, from the Dodgers to the Giants was like General Grant going and taking over the Confederate Army.
Yeah.
It's just unbelievable.
Well, we got to take a break here, Paul. We'll come back. We'll talk more about Leo Durocher, quite a character. Hang on, okay?
Sure.
All right, Paul Dixon is with us, a terrific writer. And Leo Durocher, Baseball's Prodigal Son, is his latest book. We're going to come back and talk all about Leo the Lip right after this on 720 WGN. Put me in cold. I'm ready to play. Yeah. Today, welcome back, everybody. How are you? Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN. That's baseball season is underway. And my guest right now is Paul Dixon, is the author of more than 60 nonfiction books, many of them about baseball. His latest book is about Leo Durocher. It's called Leo Durocher, Baseball's Prodigal Son. It's a terrific book about a really fascinating and colorful character. Welcome back, Paul.
Thank you, Nick.
Always a pleasure to have you on the show, sir.
Yes, sir.
Okay, let's talk about Leo Durocher. He was such a character. How did he get into baseball?
It's really an amazing story. He was a kid sort of the wrong side of the tracks. He grew up in Springfield, Massachusetts. He's of French-Canadian extraction. He goes to work at he's a good athlete, loved basketball, football, baseball as a kid growing up. Never even made it to high school, but, you know, ends up working in a motorcycle battery factory in Springfield. And there's a black man there who becomes a very close friend of his named David Redd. And David Redd watches Leo play, and he keeps pushing him. He said, you should try out for the Hartford Senators. Well, the Hartford Senators was pretty almost like a farm team for the Yankees. That's where they sent Lou Gehrig before they sent him to the Yankees.
Mm-hmm.
And he makes the team. And after Red really pushes him, the first season, he's so fantastic as a defensive player that all of a sudden the Cubs, the St. Louis Cardinals and the Yankees are trying to sign him, and the Yankees end up signing him, send him for 2 years in the minors, and then comes back full fledged as a member of the Murderers Row Yankees.
Yeah,
and so that's how he gets started, and he's really a good. I mean, people say he's the greatest defensive, not batter, but defensive shortstop of the pre-World War II era.
And it's really the accomplishments that he had were just pretty stunning if you look at the numbers, you know.
Oh yeah, all the way through. I mean, except the big flaws, of course, batting. But even as a manager, he had 95 career ejections. when he actually retired, John McGraw is the only one that had more ejections than he had at that time. You know, but and it's, you know, even as a player, you know, 3 All-Star games. One of the All-Star games as a player, he hits a home run bunt. He makes the whole way around. He's fast, too.
Yeah.
And then, of course, his accomplishments are huge because he's got the Giants for the Bobby Thompson home run, that famous on the drive. You know, and he probably has the greatest, that's his greatest period, because he brings up, he integrates, just as he integrated the Dodgers, he integrates the Giants with Henry Thompson, Monty Irvin, and then Willie Mays.
And that's a, and by the way, that's a really interesting and a wonderful part of the book, Paul, that you covered that.
Oh, thanks.
It's like a second story to what the book is really about, and you do it beautifully.
Thank you. And it, of course, what happens to him? He's transformed. You know, he's really bullies his players to get them to perform. But when he gets to the Giants, and in 49, he gets these two guys, Henry Thompson and Monty Irvin. Well, both of these guys are combat veterans. Henry Thompson's been in the Battle of the Bulge. Monty Irvin's been in the D-Day invasion, and he can't treat them like, you know, 18-year-old kids and push them around. He's got real men on there that he's facing, and he rises to the occasion. He rises to the occasion with Mays, and he produces this phenomenal team. And then he's out of baseball. He goes into show business.
I mean,
that's what's amazing about him, is he goes into show business. NBC hires him for $75,000 a year and picks him up as a comedian and somebody who can get, you know, Frank Sinatra to show up on the Dinah Shore show. I mean,
it's insane.
He ends up with, you know, he's in Mr. Ed. He's in the Beverly Hillbillies. I mean, he's a character.
Yeah,
you
absolutely.
Know, the Munsters, you name it.
Yeah, I remember vividly when I was a kid, I loved the episode of the Munsters with him. I loved it. But, like, he was buddies with Sinatra. He lived with George Raft. He was married to Lorraine Day. I mean, he was true Hollywood at that point.
He became him, and he had really three stages that he performed on. It would be Broadway, Chicago, and Hollywood. But even when he went out, finally went back to baseball and was a coach for the Dodgers, third base coach, everyone in California really thought of him as the manager, and that's what got him on all these TV shows.
Yeah.
And then, of course, he ends his career. And this is what's fascinating. He starts his career in New York in the middle of Prohibition, where he's hanging around with George Raft. And he goes from there all the way through the moon landing to the Houston Astros. You know, that's his last team. So
incredible.
He bridges it's like the 20th century. And he's in Chicago for the, you know, the Chicago 7. And he's in Chicago during the most tumultuous time you can imagine.
Yeah. Yeah. And let's talk about Chicago, his run with Chicago, particularly the 69 Cubs. I had the pleasure of getting to know and being friends with the late, great Ron Santo.
Yeah.
And Ronnie was pretty outspoken about his thoughts on Leo DeRocher. Now, you mentioned before the break that some of the collapse that happened to the 69 Cubs, much of that can be blamed on DeRocher. And can you give me a little reasoning behind that?
Reasoning behind it, he had become, by the 69, Leo DeRocher was preoccupied with a lot of other things, including a new marriage. He had was gambling a lot. He had, before the season opened, he goes to Las Vegas and wins $10,000. I mean, he puts this on his taxes, so this isn't some gossip column thing that he wins $10,000. But he's preoccupied with a lot of stuff. He's angry. He really, really, really hates Ernie Banks. He's trying to get Bernie Banks off the team. The Wrigleys won't let him. He does things to demoralize. During the 69 season, he insults his players. He insults his coaches. He will not use his bench. And you know, later, people like Ferguson, Jenkins, and others just open up about this.
Yeah, yeah.
And he berates. He keeps trying to get rid of Banks, and Banks just keeps coming out there and performing and insults him. And, you know, when he finally – and he's off – the famous thing is this Camp Ojibwe incident where he disappears. He leaves a game in progress, says he feels sick, leaves the park, and everybody's really worried about him. The Wrigleys actually sent a doctor to his house to, you know, see what's wrong. He now is flown up into Wisconsin to Camp Ojibwe, which was also the Alan Sherman Hello Mother Ho.
Yeah, yeah,
that's the camp. And he shows up there, and of course he thinks he can slither in because his stepson is at the camp and not be observed. Well, there's other parents calling, hey, Leo's here, and they have big signs, welcome Leo. And then to make it worse, he's chartered this plane to fly up there. Then to make it worse, it gets fogged in. And he misses another game. And the Wrigleys sort of say, well, Leo be Leo. But for Chicago, I went through all the papers.
Yeah.
And I looked at the oral histories and talked to some of the players and stuff. It was a slap in the face to that team. Said, the heck with you guys. I can lie about leaving. And if a player had done that, the player would have been suspended. He would have been, who knows, they would have thrown him in the closet.
Yeah.
But here's Leo. And he did, even at the end, as it became apparent that they were going to lose, that they had lost to the Mets.
Yeah.
He said, I could have picked 9 broads out of the stands and they would have been better than these bums.
The quote is insane. It really is.
And then in 70, he has his second clubhouse revolt, is when he asks the players what they think of him. And I think, there's various versions of what happened, but it became really rocky in that clubhouse. But one version has that Sando had got him in a headlock to kill him.
that's a true story, Paul. I've heard that from the mouth of Ron Santo.
And of all the people, and part of his problem with Ron Santo was very emotional. Ron Santo had diabetes, as we know now.
Yeah.
But at one point he had gone to the Wrigley's. Santo had said, look, I want to tell the world I've got this dreaded disease, and I want to use it as a fulcrum to get more money for diabetes. So the Wrigley said, all right, we're going to have a Ron Santo game day. You're going to make the announcement, and we're going to deposit a certain amount of the proceeds to diabetes. Well, DeRocher completely misunderstands this, or maybe did it on purpose, and he attacks Santo for grandstanding. Oh, you got a special day. Leo doesn't get a special day. There's a Ron Santo day. He misses the whole point. It's not about Ron Santo. It's about diabetes. It's about kids with diabetes.
This is, oh, man. Listen, there are a ton of great stories in this book, Paul. And as usual, you wrote them beautifully. And I just think you're a terrific writer, and it's always a pleasure to have you on. Leo DeRocher, Baseball's Prodigal Son. We barely scratched the surface of this guy's personality, but it's all here in the book, and it's a great read. Paul, it's always a pleasure, man. And I hope you have a great baseball season.
Thank you, Nick.
Okay.
You too.
Take care. There you go. Paul Dixon, tremendous writer, entertaining guy. And this book, Leo DeRocher, Baseball's Prodigal Son, loaded with amazing stories. And his book on Bill Veeck is also great. Make sure you check that one out, too. Okay, we'll take a break here on 720 WGN.